And now, spooky lovelies, I am so pleased to share with you this evening an episode from our dear friends at Fear Daily. If you are a fan of the Magnus Archives, Black Tapes, and Archive 81, or even if you're not, let me tell you of their terrors. Daily, from Monday through Friday, Fear Daily is reliably chilling, bringing you two new stories of hauntings, monsters, cults, and killers, all from the 90s or before. Some are the stuff of your nightmares, but some may even be true, or will be. Written by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys podcast, and narrated by the excellent Brandon Scheck Snyder, creator of Southern Gothic, Fear Daily is pure handcrafted horror from two veteran storytellers. I'm thrilled for you to enjoy these fine stories of theirs, and then to add them into your feed, wherever fine, frightful podcasts are found.
When the internet began, bulletin board services, or BBS, became the first online communities of the so-called information superhighway. Using their phone lines, people logged in from all over America to talk about sports, games, movies, and on one BBS in particular, share their ghost stories. Over time, those communities all went dark, except for one lone server that continues to operate somewhere in an unknown part of Pennsylvania's Rust Belt. A relic of the 1990s, veiled in mystery, it is a digital archive of humanity's strangest encounters with the unknown, as told by the people who experienced them. My name is Brandon Scheck Snyder, and you are listening to Fear Daily.
Subject: the glass is gone. User: J1M00PTR. Posted August 14th, 1998.
We had been in the house for 8 years when Laurel told me to smash the window. She said it the same way she says things like, the faucet's still dripping, or we're out of coffee. Calm and flat, like she'd already decided it wasn't worth another conversation. She didn't look up from folding the laundry, just smoothed a bath towel and said it like she was reading off a shopping list. I want it gone, she said again. That's it. I think she expected me to argue, but I didn't. The house, Graywood, go by the little bronze plaque the Historical Society stuck by the gate, sits on a rise just past the tree line outside Lenox. 3 stories tall, federal style, built in the middle of the Civil War and just drafty enough to prove it. Laurel calls it a country estate. I call it a money pit with too many windows and not enough outlets. We bought it after I sold the business. Laurel wanted land, she wanted space, she wanted to plant lilacs and have long, quiet mornings with books that smelled like old libraries. I just wanted out of the city. Somewhere I could be left alone. And for a while, we were. But then, they started coming. Kids first, teenagers, locals, I assume, maybe from Dalton or even Pittsfield, that park out on the shoulder after dark, kill the lights, and dare each other to walk up the drive. One of them even knocked once and bolted before I could get the door open. I figured it was just something in the local rumor mill, bored kids and ghost stories. It'd pass. It did not. After the kids came the couples, then the loners, the ones who never said anything, just stood there real still, didn't laugh, didn't move, didn't knock, just stared at the house like it had done something to them, always at the east parlor window. That's the original pane left on the first floor. Rippled, leaded glass, thick with tiny bubbles and imperfections that bend the light just enough to make you question what you're seeing. Laurel loved it, said it gave the room character, said it made the house feel like it remembered things. Apparently, the town agreed. Somewhere along the line, the house got folded into some local campfire story. The woman in the window, the pale figure. Nobody ever agreed on the details. Was she a jilted bride, a drowned governess, a forgotten sister? But that didn't matter. People just started treating the place like it was part of some folklore trail. Then drive out, cut the engine, and stare up at the parlor window like it was going to blink. One woman brought a camcorder, a big shoulder-mounted one, and not a little handheld. She tried to record right through the glass like she was filming a wildlife special. I banged on the window hard enough to rattle the panes and probably gave her a heart attack. But then the flyer showed up in our mailbox. Black and white, copied crooked on cheap paper. Looked like someone made it in the town library after hours. The woman in the parlor window. They say she shows herself to the guilty. They say she's still waiting. They say her name is buried in the glass. There was no return address, no explanation. A week later, someone uploaded a story about it on one of those ghost hunter pages, probably GeoCities or Angel Fire, with blinking text and a MIDI file that played green sleeves in the background. The story was a mess, said the house was cursed, said people had seen a face in the window, even heard her name whispered through the lilacs. No citations at all. It was just pure melodrama, and people bought it. In fact, they started coming in bigger numbers, in daylight, at dusk. One guy set up a tape recorder on our porch railing. A woman lit sandalwood incense and stood in the driveway whispering. Another left a stuffed rabbit beneath the lilac bush like it was a grave marker. Someone etched for her into the brick beside our mailbox with what looked like a car key. That was when Laurel had enough. "Smash it," she said. We were standing in the parlor in a late morning. She was wearing her old NYU sweatshirt, barefoot, arms folded like she was holding herself together. "You want this to stop?" she asked. "Smash the damn thing." So I did. I waited until just before sunset. Don't ask me why. Habit, maybe, or maybe I was hoping the evening light would hide whatever look crossed my face when I did it. I brought a rubber mallet into the parlor. Didn't say anything, didn't count to three, just raised it and swung. Window cracked slow, deep fractures like veins under skin. Then the whole pane buckled and fell inward, scattering across the floor with a sound like breaking ice in a metal sink. The house went still. Not quiet, still. The dog barked from the next room. Laurel flinched, and for a moment it felt like the air got heavy. Not warm, not cold, just heavy. Like the pressure dropped and didn't come back. We replaced the window the next day. Plain glass, no ripples, no romance. It looked like a hospital window. And I thought that would be the end of it, but it wasn't. It got worse. more people came. Word must have spread again. They started coming closer, too, pressing their hands to the new glass like they expected it to melt away. Someone left a cassette tape in the mailbox, white label, Sharpie letters, for her. They didn't knock. They didn't speak. They didn't acknowledge us at all. Laurel started sleeping with earplugs. I started keeping a flashlight by the bed and a hammer under it. Then the quiet came. Not peaceful, not sleepy, just flat, like the house was waiting. And that's when I saw her. First in reflections, then in corners, always in the parlor doorway, always with her head tilted slightly, like she couldn't quite remember who I was, but thought she would. She never moved, never blinked, just stared. Laurel didn't see her, didn't feel her, but she also started spending more time outside. She started avoiding the east side of the house without saying why. One morning, I found every photo frame of the stairwell tilted, same angle, as if someone had walked past and brushed their fingers along each one. And then, last Thursday, I had a crew over to check the attic insulation, and one of the guys came down early, looking pale and uncomfortable, like he'd just walked through a church he didn't belong in. He was holding a stained piece of cloth, old and torn. "Found this wedged behind one of the beams, sir," he said, avoiding my eyes. "Figured it might have been left there on purpose." He unwrapped it and handed it over. Inside was a shard of glass, thick, rippled, irregular. The edge caught the light just right and bent it like it was still remembering the shape of the room it came from. He set it down on the dining room table and left without asking for a check. It's still there. I haven't touched it and I haven't told Laurel, but I keep looking at it. And tonight, when I leaned in close, I saw someone standing behind me, and she smiled.
Subject: The Last Haircut. User: 321 SHK. Posted October 10th, 1996.
My barber Ken has been operating out of the same location as long as I've been old enough to get my hair cut. I couldn't even begin to guess his age, but I'm 35, so logically he has to be at least in his 50s. He's been around long enough for me to watch the lines around his mouth and eyes deepen and his close-cropped red hair fade to an iron gray. But until recently, it never occurred to me that I don't know anything about him. He's always been affable in that way barbers are, but our conversations have always been limited to my life or the world at large. His shop has barely changed over the years, a small 10x10 wood-paneled room with three chairs, two for waiting and the big one in front of the mirror. I don't recall ever seeing any decorations except for a black and white photo of a smiling young girl tucked into the bottom of his mirror between his clippers and the blue jug of Barbicide. One time I tried asking if the girl was his daughter, but he just smiled at me and deftly redirected the conversation toward what the drillers had been up to. I was never one to turn down conversation about baseball, so that was the end of my questions about the girl in the photo. She wouldn't pass back into my mind until yesterday. Ken's hours have always been 11 to 8, Monday to Saturday year-round. Some days you'd even see him in the shop on his day off, sweeping or doing the books. Usually I'd try to catch him on Wednesdays an hour or so before closing, and that's when I got there last night as an orange October sunset was winding its way down to the horizon. If I stare at them too long, fall sunsets fill me with a melancholy that seeps all the way into my bones, like watching the final volley of fireworks explode at the county fair, knowing it means the long ride home isn't far away. The lights in the shop were on, but when I turned the handle, it wouldn't budge. There was a moment of dissonance while I checked my watch, then the hours on the door, as if the fading sign had somehow changed while I wasn't looking. A moment later, I saw the door to the back office open and Ken came out, his white smock as crisp as ever. He produced a key from one of his pockets and I heard the doorknob click before it turned. "Michael," Ken said jovially as he opened the door. "Hey, Ken," I said, "is this a bad time?" "Not at all. You're my last customer of the day. I've been waiting for you. Come on in, son." He closed the door behind me, locking it and giving the doorknob a firm shake to make sure it stayed that way. I shuffled from one foot to the other. Not once in 30 years of haircuts had Ken ever closed early, and the thought gave me an unexpected anxiety. "Should I sit?" "Of course, of course. How are you, Michael? How are Annie and the girls?" I hung up my jacket on the hook behind the door and sat in the chair, watching both of us in the mirror. "They're good, thanks. I'm good, too." Ken reached over top of me to put the apron in place. His aftershave, whatever it was, smelled exactly the same as the first day my mom had brought me here as a boy. For just a second, I felt that moment in time right next to me, as if it was a tangible thing that could be reached if you just stretched far enough. "Hey, Ken, what's up? You never close early." I looked at his face in the mirror and watched as multiple emotions passed across his lined face. There was sadness, regret, and something that looked like excitement. He sighed heavily and picked up the clippers. "I'm retiring, Michael. When I say you're my last customer, I mean it. After we're done here, I'm going to turn off the lights and lock the door. I'm sorry to say, you're going to have to find someone else to cut your hair from now on." I was dumbfounded. It was like finding out the sun was going to give up its day job. I fumbled for encouraging words. "Oh, that's, wow, I mean, congratulations, Ken. That's great. Is this a recent decision?" The clippers buzzed the plastic teeth of the comb. No, I've known this was coming for a very long time. You might say my whole life has been building towards it." Question hung in the air for several moments while he finished with the clippers, gently placing them back on the counter. "To retirement?" I finally asked. "Isn't that the idea for all of us?" It wasn't a great joke, but Ken gave me a pity chuckle nonetheless. "I suppose you're right, Michael, but no, that's not what I mean." He picked up the scissors and used them to point toward the photograph on the mirror. "Have I ever told you about my sister, Lucy?" I shook my head. "No, I suppose I wouldn't have. Sometimes I lose track of the conversations I've had with people in my head and the ones we've had in real life. I've always wanted to tell someone, but it's not an easy thing to hear, and I suppose I've also been afraid that if I told the wrong person, they might try to stop me doing what I need to do. Well, Michael, let me tell you about Lucy." He stepped behind me and began cutting my hair while he talked. "We grew up on a homestead near the Washita National Forest. Lucy was my younger sister, and I loved her very, very much. Our mother died giving birth to her, and my father always blamed Lucy for that. It wasn't fair, of course, but grief and fairness rarely have much to do with each other. I did what I could to protect Lucy from our father, but even I could only take so much. There were days he would beat me so badly with his belt that I could barely walk. On those days, I told Lucy to run, and she did, always to the forest. The forest was her safe haven. The entire time he was telling his story, Ken kept cutting my hair as precisely as ever, his voice neutral like he was rattling off box scores. One time, she was gone for 4 days. Long enough, the old man actually went looking for her. He looked for hours and hours, but in the end, she just wandered back home like no time had passed at all. When he came home and found her in the kitchen, making herself a butter sandwich, he lost his mind. It didn't matter that she somehow thought she'd actually only been gone a few hours, he still whipped her bloody. I was out at the far edge of the property doing chores and didn't know what was happening until it was too late. When I got home and saw her in that state, he trailed off, his eyes looking far beyond the shop windows. I swore I'd kill him. I told her that too as I cleaned her up and did what I could to bandage her wounds. To see what he'd done to her was, there aren't words for it. To me, it was like he'd spit in the face of God. I was furious and told her that I was going to wait until he had a skin full of booze in him, then take his head off with a shovel. It was just talk at the time, something to make myself feel better, but the more I said it, the more I wanted to do it. I wanted to feel the vibration as the spade hit his skull, the bite of the pitted wooden handle into my hands. Looking back, I guess I had a little of that old man's disease in me, that rage. Lucy begged me not to do it. She said that she'd found a place in the forest that was special, where time didn't pass like it did everywhere else. She really thought she'd only been gone a few hours instead of a few days. That she'd been going to this place for a little while now when Daddy had his fits, but that she'd never gone this far before. There was plenty of food there, fruit, mushrooms, berries, and bark, and somehow she just knew which ones to eat. She said that it was somewhere we could both go and hide a while, maybe forever. I didn't believe her, of course. Boys don't like to believe in magic because it means there's something more powerful than them out there, but Lucy kept talking about it, about how she'd found this place by accident because the grove you had to pass through to get in wasn't always there. She would explain to me how you got in, the angles you had to walk at and at what time of day, but I never listened, not really. My mind was fixed on repaying my father for the cruelty he'd done to her, not on what I thought were kids' games. There was another silence. Outside, the sun had dropped below the horizon and shadows gathered in the empty street. "What did you do?" Ken frowned. "I killed him, just the way I said I would." Lucy had been in the forest for a week at the time, and he wouldn't stop talking about what he was going to do when she came home. I couldn't let that happen, so I went out to the yard and found the heaviest shovel we had. One quick shot to the back of his head was all it took. It felt how I expected, the impact, the vibration, but there wasn't any catharsis to it. I didn't feel bad. He had been too cruel for that, but I didn't feel good either. The twitching bothered me most, his whole body spastically jerking on the ground like he was being electrocuted. It was disgusting, frankly, far more so than the blood pooling on the carpet. Just then, a pickup with a glass pack blew down the street, the souped-up muffler as loud as a cannon shot. We both jumped, startled out of our reverie, our fright followed by a mutual, nervous laugh. "I hope you don't think less of me for telling you all this, Michael. I hadn't planned to, but when I saw you, I realized it might be my last chance to tell anyone." "Ken, what you guys went through, I can't imagine what that must have been like. My father drank, but it was never like that. Living out in the boonies like that, I don't know what else you could have done short of run away." He nodded at me, his eyes meeting mine in the mirror. "I suppose that's what I should have done." "What happened after your dad? Did Lucy come home?" His face clouded. Bad timing is what happened. The blood hadn't even begun to dry when a sheriff's cruiser pulled up outside. He wasn't even there on official business. He was gonna buy some old equipment my father had posted up at the hardware store in town. It's almost funny looking back on it. Did he arrest you? Oh yes. I was charged with second-degree murder and offered a 20-year sentence if I pled guilty. The district attorney at the time was a deeply conservative man who took a dim view of children raising their hands against their elders, even if they're badly treated. If I hadn't taken the plea, they were going to try for the death penalty. The injustice of it infuriated me. But you're a kid. There's no way they would have gone through with that. Ken shrugged. Maybe, maybe not, but I was just a young man and my lawyer advised me not to take the risk, so I listened. In the end, I served 15 years, in case you ever wondered where I learned to do this. At that, he lifted the scissors away from my head and gave him a wiggle in the mirror, their polish catching the overhead light. He winked and went back to cutting. What happened to Lucy? That's complicated, you see. When I was released, the only place I had to go was home. It had obviously been empty for years, and it was hard to see what it had become. Whatever couldn't be stolen was broken. I tried asking around, but 15 years is a long time. People move, people die. None of those who were left even remembered Lucy Connell, never mind having seen her a decade ago. I stayed in the wreck of that house for weeks, trying to find some trace of her. Then, the night before I decided to leave, I dreamed about her. She looked a little older, though not 15 years older. She was wearing a beautiful patchwork of what looked like bits of moss and leaves and bark bound up in strips of cloth. It was like something out of the Swiss Family Robinson, but she looked right at home in it. In the dream, Lucy led me over to the fireplace and pointed to a partially burned up scrap of paper that had fluttered loose when some drifter at last lit a fire in what was left of our home. When I woke up, I cried and cried, but when I went into the den and looked at the fireplace, I could see exactly that scrap of paper wedged between the bricks that lined the bottom. It was a blue-eyed miracle that it hadn't gone up entirely. What did it say? Ken smiled, his eyes a million miles away. It was from her. She'd written it 5 years before. She told me that she wished I hadn't done what I did, not because our father didn't deserve it, but because it left her all alone. God, I felt guilty about that, Michael. Anger makes you feel powerful, but it's an illusion. It's a disease that feeds on goodness and leaves regret in its wake. He was silent again for a few minutes, and I realized he had finished cutting my hair. Is that all it said? Ken picked up his brush and started running it through my hair to shake out the strays. No, she said she'd be waiting for me in the forest. She even wrote down how to get there. Did you go? He stopped brushing. His face was turned away from me, but his voice was thick. I did not. Prison had turned me into a very different person than the boy she knew, and I was afraid she wouldn't be able to love me the same. I suppose I had idealized her. I left for the city that very day. Eventually, I opened this shop here, and the rest, you know. With a flourish, he pulled the apron off me, shaking loose hairs onto the tiled floor. I stood up. His eyes were moist, but there were no tears. So, your retirement, you're going to find her? He nodded. Why now? I'm 65 years old, Michael. I'm still in relatively good health, mobile, but how long will it stay that way? Whether it's 5 years or 20, at some point, I won't be able to hike out into those woods anymore to find the angles I need to open the door. You really believe this place exists? I do. And even if it didn't, I'd still go. I would trade every remaining year in my life for the possibility of another day with the only family I've ever known. I thought back to the memory of my mother. If I didn't have Annie and the girls, What would I have given for one more new day with her? Ken refused to take my money for the haircut, and we said our goodbyes. I was halfway out the door when he called my name. I turned back to look at him for the last time. He was standing in the doorframe of the office, his white smock and hair glowing in the fluorescent lights. "Yeah, Ken? You were always a good boy, Michael, and I want you to know I'm proud of the man you've become. Give my best to Annie, okay?" Tears pricked at the corner of my eyes. I didn't trust myself to speak, so I nodded. Ken smiled at me again, then stepped into the office, closing the door behind him.
Fear Daily is an independent podcast hosted by Brandon Schecksnyder and written by Brennan Storr, with Joanna Smith serving as the consulting editor, audio production by Rachel Boyd, and sound design by Southern Gothic Media. This podcast is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either products of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously. Any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, or to real events or locations, is entirely coincidental. Ad-free versions of Fear Daily are available now on your favorite podcast apps. For more information, visit feardaily.com. But move fast, before the server goes offline.